Camel Squadron, so you were on Snipes, but Camel Squadrons were told not to fly.
Oh, no.
After Barn Assist, and that they were taken apart because they were too dangerous.
No. Absolute nonsense.
Okay.
Two of them, two of the squadrons, my own old squadron, 70, two more came up to the Army, the Air Force that went up to the Army of the Rhine. We were stationed at our headquarters in Cologne, Bickendorf Airdrome. The Snipe Squadron, of course, was the one that led the field because we had the power and the height and everything else, and the range. But the others, we had two, there were three fighter squadrons there, one SE-5, one Camel, and one Snipe. That advance guard, they changed it all around a little later on, but this was just was picked to go forward. So we scouted in front of the Snipes did all the forward sniping. The SE-5 had a good range too, and it could take over some of us, but we still had the height and the on anything in the sky at that time. We had the weather gauge. But I stayed in Cologne, the end of January, early February.
So you were being the occupation?
Yes.
And the blockade was still on, is that not correct?
Oh, I don't know. Blockade, what's the blockade?
Well, the economic and...
I don't think so. As far as I know, there's no purpose to it.
No, they kept... Well, political reasons were for the Treaty of Versailles. They kept...
They were...
I'm just saying if there's any food shortages and things that you saw.
We certainly didn't live high off the hog at any time.
No, I was thinking more of the German people there.
Well, there had been great food shortages in Germany. Tremendous food shortages. They were living on cabbages and whatever they could grow. And in England, there were great food shortages. And they had children that were in England after the war, World War I, for some years that were greatly, badly underdeveloped due to the shortages of food. Well, due to inadequate food, put it that way.
Now, in Germany itself, how was part of being an occupation force? Was that interesting?
Oh, yes and no. They were most disciplined people, and very fine people. But I wasn't surprised, because we had a tremendous number of German extraction in Canada. I think I told you, when you were here before, I'm sure I told you, that my second-in-command of my squadron, taken over the squadron, my flight, was a German, Geiger, from Kittier. Well, this time I think it was changed to Kindred. When he left it, it was Berlin, Ontario. But they changed the name of his hometown to Kitchener during the war. But he came in one morning after we'd been there for a while, and he was a contemporary of mine, been in the squadron for a long time, and I guess he'd been there longer than I, for that matter. But anyway, he was one of the... the old flying corps type. So we'd been pretty well out on the town and so on, together more than anyone else. And he came in one morning in my office and he stood to attention and saluted, and I looked up and I said, "What the hell got into you this morning? What are you doing? Why didn't you pay the girl?" or something like that to him. And he said, "Well, it's nothing like that, sir." And I said, "Well, what the hell does that matter?" And he said, "Well, I've just got a letter from my mother." Well, I said, "Well, what's unusual about that?" She just asked me if I'd been to see my aunt, and she's living here in Cologne. I said, "Well, have you?" And he said, "No." And I said, "Well, why haven't you? You're not being worked to that extent." Well, he said, "I was wondering if you would go with me on Sunday afternoon, and because I don't know how these other people are going to think about it if I go calling on anybody here." I said, "Don't be stupid." Well, he said, "You don't know. After all, I'm in the boat." I said, "Sure, I'll go with you. Certainly." And I did, and she turned out to be the most charming person. She spent all her summers in England, spoke perfect English. She had two nieces there from, what's the name of the little municipality, the smallest in Europe, that have their own...
Liechtenstein. I can't pronounce
it. Liechtenstein, right close to headquarters. And they were staying with her. So, we had a beautiful China, and she gracious hostess Sunday afternoon tea, and we left our cards, and just as we were going out, she turned to Geiger and then to me and said, "I wonder if you would do something for me." I said, "Well, anything we can." She said, "Well, you know, I've got a car, a very good car, But it's been up in blocks for quite a long time, and it's not anything, so it needs to be run, because I can't get any fuel for it myself. Any, she called it essence. No, she didn't call it essence. What did she call it? The French called it essence. Whatever it was, you couldn't get gas for a car, petrol. And so we said certainly we'd come out. So we took our truck down the next morning and there the next day and got the thing off its blocks, and we put in some English petrol into it. And the thing was much too rich for it, because it has been geared for a very gentle fluid. So we had to take it back, and it would run, but it wasn't good. So we took it back and had it thinned away down with coal, with paraffin, and chiefly paraffin. And this, we just made up two or three small samples, and the car ran beautifully. So we just took a little of our gallon of petrol and a little bit of, quite a lot more of the paraffin, and we were all rolling around Western Germany and up and down the Rhine all over the place in a much better car than RCO, and he didn't like that.
What kind do you recall? Was it a
Mercedes-Benz?
Or Mercedes?
Beautiful car. Beautiful, absolutely. And it just sang like a song. Oh. So then, of course, the next thing we took, the Germans immediately, I told you their discipline, they started their operas. And since there's a curfew for them, the only trouble about it is they started their wretched opera at about something just after 4 o'clock, because they had to be on the streets at 8. So we had to go to we wanted to see the opera. What else to do? So we saw every opera pretty well there, and we took the two little beautiful girls from Liechtenstein and
riding around in a Mercedes Benz.
But the rations were not bad, because we took our ration, and we took our money by that time. We were paid in pounds instead of pence, and you could change it into Germany and in the Belgian francs first, and make a profit. And we take it. And we pooled all our money.
Yeah.
Pooled all our money. Two would go down and ride in
the car.
No, not in the car. We didn't drive the car. We had a German Albatross. A D5 Albatross. We've taken off all the guns, painted our circles on it, and we used that as our transport aircraft to bring food from Boulogne. And naturally, it brought liquor and everything else. And we, by landing in Brussels and changing the Belgian francs into Boulogne and into French francs, and then back to Germany and into marks, we were just making a killing. And each time we had that all beautifully worked out, and we were able to live much better than we would have done, and it didn't constitute much. Well, after all, what are you going to do? You're there, and you
the opportunity have to, presents itself, and only the fool doesn't.
A little training in business too. A little training in business.
That's tremendous. Now, you were made what, a flight lieutenant while you were here?
Acting.
I
was
here
the end of the war.
End of the war. Now,
then I came back to England, and after I got back, and I went in the Air Force, the Canadian Air Force. The two squadrons were still in England.
Mm-hmm. And this would be the CAF.
It is the CAF, the mm-hmm. first CAF in existence. Yes. And our main job was to take all the British gift. The British gave about £5 million worth of beautiful motor vehicles, great four-wheel drive trucks, lorries, everything that we needed in aircraft, everything that we needed to start up a new aircraft, our Air Force, in Canada. Yeah. And they did the same to the other divisions. So I don't say the same proportion, but whatever proportion they've done, it's all in their book. But we had, our job was to go to France and whatever was necessary, get it, collect it, get it back to England.
So you were really seconded then to the Canadian.
Well, by this time we were definitely paid by.
Now, were you what? With
we were right out of the Air Force.
Right out of the RAF.
Yes, it was controlled right from the Air Ministry, but we had a little bench in the Air Ministry.
I see, but you didn't have to worry about resigning your commission in the RAF.
Well, it was just traded automatically. There's no. It worked out. No problem. But I stayed on that. We stayed on that until just as soon as our government in Ottawa found out, well, as soon as they knew that we'd got all these vehicles, got it all in boxes and crates and shit, and it was shipped, then they disbanded the two squadrons in England. They were never brought back to Canada. So I was a little miffed about that, and I went. The Royal Air Force offered me a permanent commission, but they also offered me. I didn't want to go, make up my mind to that because I have a little time. They said, "Well, you can have a short service commission, and you can change if you like them." So I a short service commission. And I stayed in England. I decided to get all the training courses I could.
Yeah.
But I didn't tell them, and they didn't tell me anything. You just put your name down. Well, after you could have three, and they wanted you to get three. It was a good idea. One in bombing, if you like, or one in guns, the armament. Another in navigation. Mm-hmm. Another in wireless, if you wanted to explore in that. Another would be in administration and organization, and so on. So after the three, then I started easing back. So I just sit back. Instead of putting your name down when they came up for application and volunteers, I'd wait till it was filled up. Say nothing. But if it wasn't filled up at the end and it was going to close, then you'd go and see your CEO and say, "Well, sir, if you'd like to have another Joe, I'm available." And I got two more. So I ended up with five special courses. And by that time, it was getting pretty hot in Canada, and then I quietly asked to resign, and I came back to Canada, and came straight right from Canada when the farm was being formed here. But at that time, we were largely a little training unit at Borden, and I didn't want that. I wanted to get out in the other one in the field, and then they put us in the civil service in what they called for about a year and a half.
The aerial photography, and
mapping, everything under the sun, firefighting. Mm-hmm. We were working largely for any department of government, but chiefly through the Department of the Interior. At that time, that is what they called the Department of the Interior. We covered a lot of sins and fields, and the Department of Indian Affairs to get their troops around, their people around all over Canada. So we were with the RCMP. That's where we flew with the RCMP on the coast out here against the rum runners and everything else here again on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. We did all that first flight. The RCMP didn't get their own aircraft at all until in the 30s. Mm-hmm. And then we did all their flying for them. So the Air Force itself grew right up, and then right up to 1939 when war broke out, we were still doing a good deal of work. Well, not only bushfires, that was part of it, but a lot of other work. The Air Force, all the way, sang for its supper.
Yeah.
And it's a good thing, because in the summertime, we were out in the north, and we had to work. You had to work like the devil to keep your aircraft running at that distance away. It's most interesting work, new work, new fields, and in the wintertime, you had to catch up with all your military training. So it's a good job. There's no fooling.
I believe you, sir. I think that's
about enough.
I think so. And if I can come and see you again, and we can maybe discuss the early parts in the RCAF.
All right.
And hopefully get into the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan, which I know you were greatly involved with.
Well, yes. to me, I had a good bit to do with that information.
Mm-hmm.
I've been asked extraordinary questions, whether the... Douglas asked me a lot of questions along that line, and I got Alec Douglas.
Oh, Dr. Douglas from Ottawa, yes, of course.
And, he was out here, and he asked me a lot of questions along that guy. And then I said, well, go back out and send me your questions, and I'll see if I can answer them. So he did, and I got another paper, something like this, only on...
Tremendous.
But I don't know that we'll even for the we'll listen to it first. I criticized very freely and very fully the great mistakes that were made by Mackenzie King, mm-hmm. and Angus MacPhail and all the others that killed the youth in Canada. I remember being in Ottawa. Oh, after we were doing very well in war too, and that was pretty late in the war before we started doing well. And we'd had a conference in Ottawa. They were there from all over the place, from England and United States. And see, the United States have been always working very closely with us in the war. In World War I, there were four, I think I told you this before, and I'm repeating myself to you a lot of the time because I'm damn sure I told you this, but we had four United Americans in our course of 28, my course of flying in the flying corps. When I went at the flying corps, there were only 28 pupils in the class. Well, you have 28 pupils in one class at one time. That's just about the right number. You get a bigger class than that, you can't give the individual attention to them.
Attention.
And if you get them too small, well, then you're wasting your instructor power. So somewhere around that, 25 to 30, I don't want more than 30 and much less than 25. Mm-hmm. Depends on how you got it organized, but that worked out very well. That is the neat number that they used, and so four of them were Americans up here, but they hadn't gotten to war yet. Now, we had them in the Army all the way through, too. I remember my first job when I was in the Army, Buck Private, one of my first jobs on guard duty, and we had an American fellow in the tent. And he went off on leave, and then he loved to bend his elbow, and he'd got himself one or two too many. And, of course, he came in late, and he got sacked in the soccer, and then I guess maybe the first time he got away was a time or two, but they put him in the guard room, and I was guarding him. And he couldn't eat the food. He had plenty of money. So I felt very sorry for this fellow. He's a darn nice fellow, but he just got himself drunk. when I was off, see, you were 2 hours on and 4 hours off. Mm-hmm. But you were right there. You couldn't go away very far.
For a walk,
Well, you could if you arranged it with your guard commander. Yeah. and he couldn't, this guy, the fellow, after his drunk, he wasn't feeling very strong on Army food. So there was a good cafe down the street, and would I please go down and get him some food? I did. Then he wanted me to take some money, and I said, no damn way, you take your own money. So he stayed around for quite a while, and they finally let him out. The American. One of the first fellows I ran into in England when I got over there. He got to England as a civilian, and he got himself a job. He's still going in the war, you know. He was keen to fight this war and win. And he got himself a job as the head boss of quite a big mess in the vicinity, right near Hounsville, where I told you about. That's where I ran. And I said, what the hell are you doing here? He was here. Well, he wasn't in uniform, of course. He was a civilian, just a business manager. And my God, his eyes lit up, you know, and he remembered it all. And he again wanted to take us out to dinner and so on. And said, well, another time when we got a chance, but my God, as soon as the war was over, I went to Savoy. There he was, in the most in evening clothes, the most perfectly dressed son of a gun. And I says, you S.O.B. So he said, now you'll have a drink with me and the dinner. And he said, oh, damn it, of course I will. But that was an American. Now, I'm going to tell you, now the same thing happened, only in a much bigger way in War II. War II, they were up here like nobody's business. And I had them all the way they were here within 48 hours after the war broke out on the 3rd of September.
Well, we had, at least you got a letter from Harry Truman. Did you get one from Mackenzie King?
No, well, not like that. he didn't like my guts anyway because he knew that I didn't like the way he worked. and so did Agnes MacPhail.
Well, you really figure Agnes and Mackenzie were the bugaboos, eh?
Well, I think Agnes MacPhail was more sinned against than sinning. She was a woman and, of course, school teacher and maybe a damn good one. But whenever she spouted off in the house, she got a headline. Now, some of the others could do it and wouldn't get a headline, and they wanted a headline. Uh-huh. And all along in 37 and 38 and 39, and from 35 on, we knew damn well, all of us had gone through the staff college and had the staff training under Trenchard and all his teeth. Mm-hmm. The war was coming. We didn't know when. That was an act of whatever you want to call it. Not necessarily of God, but an act of Hitler and whoever. Every time that we would ask for a new aircraft, we were salesmen of death, the magazine sales work. Now, the press loved that. And then she could blow that up beautifully. She's purred and stuck out whatever she had here, and thought it was great. Well, Jesus, when war came along, my job, I was director of training for 2 years before war, because my job was to build up the training staff. If this thing came on, we never dreamed it would be half the size that it did turn out to be. But we knew damn well. See, I think, damn it, I told you this before, that they sent out Jim Robb. Group Captain Jim Robb, and he came out, and I was at D.C. at that time. We'd both been at the Staff College, both on Trench's team, both. So they'd sent him out to try to persuade us to do the right things in the right way. And it was a damn good idea, because after all, they had the machinery and the time to think it out that we hadn't. And anyway, Trencher had thought it out. It was beautifully done.
And he's very proud of Trencher.
Oh, well, hasn't you read his book?
Not yet,
though. Oh, Jesus, well, they should. I'll loan it to you if you'll...
I'll have to wait a bit until I'm finished this summer, I think.
Oh, all right. That's your job. Right now, I'm going busy.
Well, so
but you can come and get it again if you will. Yeah, he was the brain.
He was.
Wait till I see what the Americans... Have I got it here?
Don't worry about it, sir.
Well, I speak very highly of him. He was the brain. The United States senior officers said, one of well, men at the top, if Trenchard had been of German, the Germans would have won the war, because there'd been no defense of London, you see. There'd been no Air Force Staff College. Because Trenchard was the man who had his team.
Mm-hmm.
And he built a team. Any good man builds a team, because you can't do it all yourself. So he built the team that had the brains, and he had them too. He also revamped the Scotland Yard, the great police deal in England. He headed it there afterwards, and he had to rebuild that damn thing from the ground up. How they hated his guts. But barbers, they were doing a poor job. But coming back to... Mackenzie King and Agnes, we had all these new aircraft that were coming in. We had no time to test them. We had no time to... They were manufactured. We didn't have anything. We had no aircraft at all. All trainers and crop dusters, all sorts of damn things. And bush flying aircraft. But we were supposed to turn our fighter pilots on, and other pilots. Well, the aircraft wouldn't do it. I refused to let them fly in my command unless I could put it through them. My God, we were killing our instructors and pupils. And on one particular elementary aircraft, it had a fin that we couldn't find. They didn't find it in the United States. They manufactured it. And this is all well, and as I say, well into the war, about the second year, third year. And this damn thing was busting up. And it would bust up in the air, usually at a height. And the wings would fold and seal the pilots in, and they were wearing parachutes, but they couldn't get out. And they'd go straight in.
What plane was that?
Well, fighter,
that?
Yes, I can tell you that. I've got it in my book. But we couldn't prove it. How do you know it wasn't a pilot there? How do you know it wasn't? All right. I remember one day we'd had a trouble in North Battleford. It's way outside of Edmonton, and I'd flown out there for this damn row, and I couldn't sleep that night very well, and the next morning I got up at the crack of dawn before, and it was still dark, and the team, I was sleeping next door, and they heard me, and they got up damn quick in the hotel, and we all said, oh, let's get the hell out of here and go back to the work. So we flew over, and by the time we got over into Alberta, the morning was coming on, it was daylight, and we flew right down over to the main spine between Calgary and Edmonton, then we started to run south. And there was a little aerodrome in there, an elementary aerodrome, and I'd never been able to visit the damn thing. And they were just wheeling out their aircraft in the morning. And I don't know, it was out of a whim. I thought, oh, geez, I'm just going to drop in and see how these buggers have breakfast. So I flew my aircraft in, and up came the sergeant major. None of the officers had got up there at all. Up came the sergeant major, and he was much dismayed. Oh, the hell, what are you doing here? And he saw the brass hat and a few things, and And I stepped out and I said, good morning, Sergeant Major. And he said, good morning, sir. And did you mind putting a couple of tubes on this machine and just turning it around and lock it up? And see, I didn't have, I only had one little mechanical on with plus my couple of staff officers. So he said, well, I think the order officer will be around somewhere, sir. I haven't seen him yet. And I said, well, don't you worry. What's wrong with you? Let's walk up and down the line here and see these aircraft of yours come out. So we walked up and down the goddamn line, watching them all coming out. He'd see the sergeant look around and everything was going well. And he got a messenger. I saw him getting a messenger off to find that guy on that road. He caught up with me. And he said, well, I haven't seen any of the COs. It was pretty early. And he looked at his watch and said, it's all right. I said, it's all right. I just happened to be going in. And I sort of dropped down and said, oh, good morning to you. He said, you might ask me to breakfast if you will. He said, do you mean up at the mess? And the officer's mess? I said, no, in your mess. What's wrong with you? You change your food? And he said, oh, no, sir. Well, I said, I'll come back to you. Well, in about 15 minutes, somebody got a message to the CO, and he was out. And I told him the morning that I was just having a look, see how things are going. And so I was just coming back from Battleford, and with him, I told him the truth. The truth. And I said, well, I've already asked the Sergeant Major to have me for breakfast, and I hope you don't mind. Well, his face, he said, I guess he's never had breakfast with the Sergeant Major, by the look of him. But I was going to have breakfast with the Sergeant Major. What the hell? I want to see how the troops seem to live, too, you know. More important than anything else. Well, Jesus. We went in, and we didn't go into breakfast immediately. Then a bunch of some of the officers began to get to their aircraft by that time, and I talked to what I wanted. They were using this aircraft I was telling you about, mm-hmm. And that was one reason I thought I'd go in and see them. So I knew that I was talking to a flight lieutenant in charge of the flight that knew the job very well, and he was a damn good man, an A1 flying instructor. And I discussed the thing with him, pro and con. What the hell was wrong with that goddamn aircraft? I said, I know damn well that two-thirds of these instructors that are being killed are bloody good men, and this thing has happened too damn many times, and we can't get our fingers out. What are we to do? Well, he agreed with every damn thing, and then he opened up and gave me the works, too, from his point of view, and that's exactly what I went for. We knew there was something there, but what the hell was it? What was sealing these people in? So I left them and flew back to Calgary, and by God, as soon as I got into Calgary, I'll be goddamn. Now, this sounds almost unbelievable, but I got a telegram, and the same goddamn instructor that I'd been talking to in this pilot, they must have tried out the damn things again, or whatsoever. They were killed and burned in the plane. Well, by that time, I was just tearing my hair. What the hell to do? And you know, we got the answer. But it had met Sudax in getting it. We had another instructor down at Moss Bank, way down from Regina, down in the neck of the woods. And he was out buzzing a school teacher just at the evening. And he must have put his aircraft into the same damn maneuver. And I'm damned if he didn't crash his aircraft. But he was so close to the ground, it didn't have time to get into a spin, and he crashed. Mm-hmm. And it didn't burn and didn't catch up. Then it happened. I got the telephone thing. I immediately got on the phone to the CO to put a guard around that goddamn plane at 100 feet out, and another one beyond that, and didn't let anyone within that goddamn thing arm them with guns and rifles and orders. No touch, no how, until we got there. And the guy that designed that was my... I grabbed him, and he was my boss, Bain, anyway, and a couple more, and I flew just out of headquarters like a shot in the night by the time we got there. And the little village of Moss here, I thought that we picked up something from Mars with all this goddamn garbage. And, but we got the machine intact. Before we all the way out of the... See, when all that fire gas explodes and burns, the engines would melt. You'd chip it apart and get a leg or a bone out or some goddamn thing. Stop this world.
What was it anyway?
Well, it's this. You've got to go get your wife. The thing was that the center section part, where the controls and everything else had to go out to the wings,
mm-hmm.
were sealed in such a way that all the flying parts were perfect. But in landing, doing the circuits and bumps and landings, you see, with the pupils, and even a poor pilot or a bad aerodrome would bump on top. And those fittings were being worn on taxi. It wasn't the flying at all. But when you're upside down, the weights changed, and the damn thing, or when you got, yes, or when you got banked at a certain angle. But the design in wartime was hurried. They didn't catch it, and that was the weakness. But it was sealed in such a way that no one would have ever caught it unless we got the evidence. That's where we got the evidence. So, but we
made, Agnes and Mackenzie King have to say about it.
Well, wait, they got it in a little while. I immediately sent a wire to put a court of inquiry right on to the thing, and I sent a wire to Ottawa telling them what we'd done, and that we had what we thought was tremendously important evidence. I didn't say this is it. We knew we were sure, but. And they all sent one to Washington because it was their plane. Same repeat, mm-hmm. Washington repeat. Ottawa said, "Oh, you know, not Washington." They had people there in no time. And they also bought the manufacturer's representatives. Then Ottawa, the tops were madder than hell. And, I said, "Well, you go back and read your wire. You'll find that the wire came to you and was repeated to Washington and to." And was the company, the aircraft. They wanted to put their troops in and look at it. We wanted them to see it. Because, after all, their brains were going to be just as good or better than ours. But they didn't do a goddamn thing. They didn't get the Tubby Power. He was the one that was mad. And so hell, from there, I used to call right directly the chief of the air staff or to Tubby any goddamn time I liked. And Ottawa didn't like that much. I never got browned off for doing it either. But I didn't call him unless I was pretty goddamn sure of my ground. Once or twice I'd done it. But anyway, Agnes came into this fair. There was a conference down in Ottawa. And I'd been down there for about 2 days on this goddamn thing, and I was really logged. Mm-hmm. And you fly down there and all this damn thing. And the Americans put on the American embassy. Here's the best. Here's the guy in the book.
They go out party reception in the Seattle in the Quebec Suite.
Mm-hmm.
And I was standing over at the far end of the here's the foreman and the sword. I'll show you the sword upstairs there again when you got time.
Mm-hmm.
Here, you like to see the foreman?
Sure.
Quickly. That was way back when I was a wing commander. Here's the sword.
Okay.
My handiwork. There's my horse.
She
came to the party.
She came to this party you went to.
Yeah, I didn't know she was there.
Uh-huh.
I was standing over in the corner, just being very quiet, having a chat with the people from Washington. And she came over and said, "I hear that you don't want to meet me? I said, well, I'm sure I don't remember saying that, Miss McPhail. I'm sure I don't remember that. I said, well, why are you? So I said, well, you remember every time that one of my boys crashed an aircraft and so on, we wanted a new aircraft for the war and train our people, train our instructors, trying to build up our staff. You used to say, every time we asked for an aircraft, we had a dollar to buy it. Salesman of death. So I said, well, let me tell you this, that every time that I stand at a graveside now, and one of our Canadian youths, they're killed and buried unnecessarily, I don't exactly say a prayer for you. She burst into tears and ran away, and I didn't feel very proud of myself. But I'd had a lot of good liquor.
A little too much drink, eh?
Well, I think she had it coming to her.
Well, thank you very much, eh?
Now I want you to take those roses.
I will, sir. Thank you.